This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. This week on Financial Sense Lifetime Income segment, we're going to be talking about a topic a lot of you keep asking about. Is it time to get back into real estate again? Now, many of you have asked us this. You've asked us about commercial real estate. You've asked us about more private real estate. Well, today we're going to have Danny Evanson from the RMA Group talking with Jim about this exact issue. So stay tuned later on the program to hear more about investing in real estate.
Now, we have been devoting, since we started Lifetime Income over the last couple of years, it's all been about retirement, how to prepare. And of course, you know, we've made a great emphasis on having a retirement plan, preparation prior to making that decision to retire. It is going to be one of the biggest decisions you're going to make in your lifetime. The average adult is expected to spend nearly a quarter of their adult life spent in retirement. If you retire at age 65, between you and, let's say, your spouse, you can expect between 20 and 25 years spent in retirement between the two of you. And if you look at the demographics that we're starting to see in this country right now, nearly 10,000 Americans are turning age 65 just about every day. Now, here's the sad statistic. Less than 30% of them have a retirement plan. And not to mention, for example, the number of individuals who now find themselves in retirement prematurely. Maybe they got laid off, something happened to the company, it got bought out, but you thought you were going to retire 5 years from now. All of a sudden, due to, let's say, the economics of what's going on at your place of employment, you now find yourself retired.
I think this is a really important issue. And why we keep pounding a table about this, Jim, is that when you have a plan, it helps you feel more prepared for just even knowing, are you ready to retire? And let's say something unexpected does happen to you. You have a plan. You can know how to tweak it to maybe make the early retirement still work for you, which is basically helping you to prepare for the unexpected if it occurs. And one thing I've noticed is that for clients who have a plan, some kind of financial plan, especially one that focuses on their retirement, when they make the decision to retire on a specific date and time, they have a lot of confidence in that decision. And something else I've noticed about folks with plans, Jim, is that their plans typically have different types of investments that are meant to address different parts of their retirement needs. And they tend to be more confident and less jittery when things happen in the market because they know that each portion of their investment portfolio serves a specific function for them. And something else too, Jim, is that we've also discussed here and discovered that there's really no one size fits everyone retirement plan, no one size fits everyone financial plan. Everyone's a little different. You've got a different spend rate. You've got a different risk tolerance. You've got a different situation going in terms of what kind of assets you've got set aside, whether or not you have pensions or social security. So really whatever plan you end up having needs to be something that you and your family feel comfortable and confident with, and one that really fits and suits you and your specific situation.
Now let's get back to making that decision to retire. Let's say you're turning age 65, age 66. You're saying, I've wanted to wait till I reach full retirement age to get my Social Security. So now you're there. Now, I'm assuming if you've made a plan, then you're going to be okay because you know what your expenses are. You know what your variable expenses are. You know what your income, where it's coming from, how dependable and predictable it'll be. And also, you put into your plan, you've made some provisions for those contingencies. What happens if one of you gets sick? Or let's say your plan assumes that you'll be working part-time or at least one spouse. And more importantly, you know what's in your portfolio. As Kathleen just mentioned, every asset plays a role, whether you have an annuity, whether you have a bond, whether you have stocks, mutual funds, but you know how that fits in supplying and meeting your retirement needs. And, you know, there's all kinds of assets we've talked on the program. Today, we're going to talk about a different asset with my guest about real estate. So every asset has a supporting role in your retirement. I don't care if it's annuities to fixed income or Social Security to provide that fixed or basic expenses, dividend stocks to provide for, let's say, inflation, maybe some gold and cash for emergencies or that unexpected financial event. Where I want to go next is address those who don't have a plan and have piled into one asset, which we've seen and become very commonplace over the last couple of years.
You know, Jim, I'm really glad we're going to be talking about this today because we run into this an awful lot. And I think one of the main problems with not having a plan, Jim, is that you really don't understand the long-term implications of inflation. And so you find yourself in a situation where maybe you've created a portfolio that's directed towards some kind of a doomsday scenario. So maybe all your assets are in bond funds. Maybe they're in gold or in cash. And you've set up a situation for yourself where you're not really watching what's happening to your principal in your portfolio and its purchasing power. You know, after 6 years at 0% interest rates, a lot of people are starting to panic, especially if they don't have a plan, because what they're doing is they're finally realizing that after 6 years of sitting on the sidelines or doing these other types of investments without a plan, is that they're starting to eat into their principal and their standard of living is starting to be affected.
And along those lines, one of the issues and some of the problems that come up is when you have no plan and let's say you retire and you retire, for example, if you retired over the last couple of years, the stock market has been going up. But the problem is, what happens when we have another bear market? And I can assure you, folks, we will have another bear market. I'm not sure. The technicians we have on the program seem to think that we're a ways away from that. But at some point, we will have another bear market. Now, we've talked about the 4% rule. So, for example, let's suppose that you were doing very well with your savings. You put away a lot of money. You retired January 1st of 2000 with $1 million. Now, you were pulling out 4% a year, which is $40,000. And you're thinking, you know what? $40,000 a year with $1 million portfolio, where interest rates were, where the market was going, that should last you during almost your entire lifetime. Here's the problem. The market peaked in the year 2007, and we all know what happened between 2007 and 2009. The S&P 500 lost 40%. So now, instead of withdrawing 4% of, let's say, $1 million, you're only drawing 4% of anywhere from $600,000 to $700,000. And here's another issue that a lot of you have ended up facing. And that is, with 0% interest rates and quantitative easing, interest rates have come down. I don't need to tell you, if you have money in a bank CD, you have money in a money market fund, you're getting nothing. And you've been getting nothing for 6 years. And according to Janet Yellen's testimony this week, it's likely to remain that way for another couple of years. And I want to give you an example. Let's say you put your money in a bond fund, like a corporate bond fund or treasuries. Now, let's take two of the most popular ETFs out there, LQD, which is corporate bonds, and TLT, which is treasury bonds. In 2007, LQD paid a monthly dividend of 49 cents. In 2014, LQD pays a monthly dividend of 34 cents. The income is down 31% from 2007. If you look at TLT, if it was in treasuries in 2007, they were paying 35 cents a month. Now they're paying 26 cents a month, or roughly a 27% decline. So 6 years later, your income is now down 30%. I bet you your expenses aren't down 30% as well. So in the meantime, how are you going to meet your expenses? Say, for example, you're spending $3,000 a month at a 3% inflation. You're going to need over $40,000. At $48,000 at a 3% inflation 6 years later, you're going to need over $56,000. If you're spending $5,000 a month or $60,000 a year, you're going to need close to $70,000. So not only have we seen a drop in assets during the bear market, which could reduce your income, but we've also seen a drop in interest rates. Now, you're in a situation, your income's down, the markets are down. What are you going to do? Chances are you've become more reactionary to various headline news. I mean, think of all the crises we've seen in the headlines over the last 2 years. Despite all that, the market's gone up. So when you have suffered something like this and you don't have a plan, you don't have a diversification, you don't know the role that these assets are going to play in your retirement, you end up becoming fearful and reactionary, which is the last thing you want to do as an investor.
Well, Jim, as you were talking about these different payout rates on the LQD and TLT, it was sort of reminding me of why we keep talking about doing laddered bonds. Now, yes, interest rates are still low, but the pro side of doing a laddered bond fund is that you have a dependable, predictable income stream, and you have maturity dates you can count on. So as those bonds mature, if interest rates go up, you roll the principal into a higher interest rate paying bond. But again, these poor folks that were in LQD, TLT, seeing their income drop by roughly 30% over 6 years is pretty painful. But with a ladder bond portfolio, you've got pretty predictable income happening there. And then the second issue you brought up, Jim, which was basically the effect of inflation on your income stream, is why we've been talking about these blue chip dividend paying stocks, is because they do have some kind of potential to grow principal, number one, but also potential to grow your income stream through dividend increases over time with these various companies. So, Jim, taking that into account, what would the scenario you just talked about, someone who was in LQD and TLT, what would that have looked like if that person, instead of doing those particular investments, had been putting money in, let's say, a ladder bond portfolio and maybe some blue chip dividend paying stocks?
Well, first of all, if I buy a bond, Kathleen, let's say I buy a 5-year bond, let's say it's paying 4% interest rate. Unlike a bond fund, I know exactly what I'm going to be getting. I'm going to be getting 4%. And when the bond matures, let's say in 5 years, I know exactly what I'm going to be getting back. So despite all the quantitative easing, all the things that have changed in the marketplace, nothing would have changed with that individual bond. If I, for example, have bought an individual stock, and I'll use Coca-Cola as an example. Yes, Coca-Cola went down during the bear market, but it didn't omit its dividend. You would have gotten the dividend every single quarter. It never changed. In fact, during that period of time, you actually got a 10% pay hike because Coca-Cola has been increasing its dividends 8 to 10% a year. So even though in the short term the stock price was down, well, the stock price went up and they ended up splitting the stock. In fact, 1 year after the downturn in 2008, a year later, Coca-Cola was back up to almost where it was had you bought it at, let's say, the beginning of the crisis. So if you owned an individual bond, the interest rates did not change. If you owned a stock, you got your dividends and those dividends went up each year. Your income did not change. The only thing that changed in the short term, there was some price fluctuation.
Jim, I feel like I should mention here that dividend investing and investing in stocks, we think it's a great portion for our portfolio, but you have to be someone who's willing to take that risk to the underlying principal that you see. Just thinking about this whole issue about securing enough income for retirement, one of the things I often notice is it seems like some of the investors that come to us without a plan really haven't thought out how they're going to secure enough income for their fixed expenses, especially their absolute must-haves, cost of living expenses. You know, as you just mentioned, if these people had been invested in some of these bond funds, recently their income would have been going down year over year while their expenses would have been going up. And something else I'm seeing a lot of too is that individuals who got really scared in 2008, 2009, and went all to cash and have been sitting on the sidelines ever since, is that, well, they haven't been earning a whole lot on their money, obviously. CDs at the bank aren't paying you a whole lot. And the problem is that, you know, their cost of living hasn't been going down. Their expenses haven't been going down. And so they keep, you know, eating into the principal, which puts you in a really tough situation. And something else that I see is that people who get nervous about having a source of income in retirement often will take Social Security a little bit too early instead of delaying taking their Social Security. You know, we've talked before in the program how if you delay your Social Security payout after full retirement age, you basically give yourself an 8% income raise every year you delay taking Social Security between full retirement age and age 70. And so what happens with these clients who've made these decisions, whether it's to stay all in cash or take Social Security a little early, is that as time marches on, and inflation starts to really compound and impact their expenses, is they find themselves in a situation where there's getting to be a widening, greater shortfall every single year between their sources of income and what they have to pay out.
And another issue, which I also see, is a failure to do, Kathleen, some tax planning, whether it's Roth conversions. You've seen this happen where somebody says, tax-free income. I will convert my IRA into a Roth. They're doing it during their working career where their tax rates, and depending on what state they're living in, they can see up to 40% of that IRA conversion go away in the form of taxes up front. And what that means now is you now have 40% less assets working for you as you head into retirement. Or let's say they get themselves in a situation where they don't have anything on the personal side. So between Social Security, their pension, and withdrawals from their IRA or pension plan, everything they have in their portfolio is taxable. So that when tax rates go up or we get rid of itemized deductions or whatever Congress has their mind on, they get themselves in a bind, or they get into a situation where they fall under what is called alternative minimum tax, where you are actually caught in this tax trap if you have too many itemized deductions, like, let's say, state taxes, interest expense on a mortgage, charitable deductions. You have too many of those. The government comes in and says, we're going to compute your tax on another basis and make sure you're paying us at least 28%.
Which is no small chunk of change. That's almost 30% of your income. That's a pretty big chunk to give away. Well, Jim, I just want to summarize really quickly here some of the points we've brought up about the people that we see that don't have a plan and some of the challenges that come out of not having a plan. Not having a plan makes it really difficult to face market downturns without getting really nervous. If you're not planning adequately, you can find yourself in a situation where your sources of income are unpredictable or decreasing year over year. Something else, you may find yourself in a situation where maybe your assets and the allocation you currently have your assets in isn't producing enough income to support your lifestyle or even meet your basic expenses. And then the last thing we often see with a failure to plan, Jim, is that these non-plans really have a hard time dealing with the unexpected, such as forced early retirement, maybe a medical situation, maybe a parent needing some additional financial support and care. And these are all things that if you've done your job ahead of time and you've done some good advanced planning, these things and these challenges won't throw you off stride because you'll have already accounted for them in your financial plan. You know, Jim, I think a good way to illustrate some of these points that we've just been covering about not having a plan is to actually discuss an actual case. So we've got Jerry and Carla Benson. You know, he's 67 now and his wife Carla is 64. And Jerry retired. He was a defense contractor. He retired a little bit early. Retired at age 62. You know, his wife, Carla, was working as a dental hygienist, and she retired recently as well. When Jerry retired, his pension was $48,000 a year. And as long as Carla was working and contributing to the family coffers before she retired, $70,000 a year was coming into the family coffers from Carla's salary. So as a family, they were bringing in almost $120,000 a year from salary and from Jerry's pension. Now, things started to get a little tight with their family because of how they had their assets allocated. So let's actually talk about what was going on with their assets. So Jerry had built up a really nice 401k at work. And when he retired, he rolled it over into an IRA, about $750,000, really nice chunk of retirement change. And Carla had her 401k too as well. And since she'd been raising the kids part of her life, her 401k wasn't quite as big as Jerry. She only had $170,000 in that. Now, they lived locally here in San Diego, nice area of town, Rancho Bernardo, where we have our office, Jim. I'm going to say it's a nice part of town if I'm allowed to say that. Their home was worth about $800,000, and they still had about half owing on that and a mortgage, so they still had some, you know, fairly hefty mortgage debt. Now, here's kind of where things get a little bit interesting. They had about $40,000 of savings in cash and CDs, which honestly, Jim, $40,000 is a nice little emergency cash stash. It's not bad. It's not paying you a whole lot, but it's definitely a nice little cash stash. Jerry also had about $150,000 still left in his company stock from his employee stock purchase plan he was had going on at work when he was still working. That's a little bit over-allocated there. So if you add up everything that Jerry and his wife had, they had about $1.9 million. Again, really seems like a pretty good, pretty solid chunk of change asset level to be in when you're in retirement. Keep in mind, they still owed $400,000 on their home. So net-net, once you take out the liabilities, their overall chunk of change, assets, investments, $1.5 million. So again, looking like a pretty nice retirement package for them right now. Got some good liquid investments, got their home. Now, here's where things started to really get difficult once Carla retired. they had fixed expenses of about $100,000 a year, also really enjoyed to travel, some nice trips, really into golf. That was $20,000 a year. So between their fixed expenses and their fun stuff, they were hitting about $120,000 a year. And it's really challenging right now to make $120,000 a year come out of a $1.5 million portfolio.
Here's where some of the problems were. They were okay. Jerry was the first one to retire. So as long as Carla was working, she was bringing in a little over $70,000 a year. They could live comfortably. Now, when Jerry took his retirement, he had the $40,000 pension that was coming in, but he made a good decision. He said, you know, I'm going to wait to age 66 because Carla's working, so I don't need my Social Security. If I wait to age 66, I will get full retirement benefits, which was $27,000. Carla taking hers early to retire eventually, hers would be $12,000. So we had $39,000 coming in with Social Security. Now, between Jerry's pension and Social Security, we had a $31,000 shortfall. The problem was when Jerry retired, like many individuals, and especially during the financial crisis, bond funds were the ideal place. That was, quite honestly, folks, almost $1.5 trillion of individual investment money has gone into the bond market. And that's exactly where Jerry put most of his. And of course, as we just mentioned with the examples of LQD, which was corporate bonds, and TLT, which was treasuries, those dividends have come down. So they didn't have enough income to make up Carla's salary. And also, the bond funds reduced their dividends each year. So even though they had almost $920,000 now in IRAs between Jerry and Carla, and also they had Jerry's company stock, that was about the only thing that was going up. It was obviously a major defense company, public company. And fortunately for Jerry, that stock dividend, it was going up. So what we wanted to do is we said, look, you've got $100,000 of fixed expenses. You've got $20,000 of what I call wish for things in your budget. That's the travel you guys want to do, you know, the golf membership and the golf fees. So, you know, your total budget's $120,000. So how are we going to get some form of stability and assurance to make sure that that $31,000 shortfall was going to come in each year? You wouldn't have to worry about stock market crashes, whether Ben or Aunt Janet now was going to lower interest rates. So we put roughly about 60% in dividend paying stocks at 3%. Jerry was a little bit more comfortable now with the kind of companies, his defense company that he worked for all his career. He had seen the dividends go up each year. And then, you know, when you talk about companies like Coca-Cola and Exxon, they were quite comfortable with that. So 60% of the portfolio went into blue chip dividend stocks that would produce an income yield roughly of close to 3%. That would produce $16,500, 40% in a laddered bond portfolio of $15,000. And then, of course, his company's stock, which was producing roughly about 2% going up each year. So that was $34,000. So we had extra income to meet their shortfall of $31,000. Now, another thing I wanted to point out here is that one of the reasons we went in a little bit more allocated to the dividend paying stocks is the money coming in from the portfolio was $34,000. That was really only a cushion of $3,000 over their budget. And as we talked about it and we talked about inflationary scenarios, I asked them to take a look at their checkbook, take a look at what their personal expenses were they were spending, what they were going up. I said, folks, we're cutting it very close here. We have a very narrow margin of safety. So we have to have something just like your defense stock that is going to increase your income each year so you will maintain your standard of living. Because if we don't and we go on to fixed income, we're going to have a problem down the road. So that was basically how we allocated the portfolio.
Again, the main problem with this retirement plan when they first came to us was really that, you know, they were okay as long as Carla was working, and then she stopped working and they started to have this, you know, major shortfall happening. And so what we were trying to do is essentially help make up some of that shortfall from Carla's salary not being there anymore. And of course, she had some Social Security that was making up for some of that. But we then supplemented that with some of the laddered bond portfolio income, the dividend paying stock income, and that helped to sort of make up that shortfall from Carla's salary being not part of the family income coffers anymore. And you combine those sources of income together along with Jerry's pension and his Social Security, and we've got most of their budget items covered so that they can feel relaxed and comfortable as far as being able to meet their monthly needs as far as a family is concerned. Now, something else to keep in mind, too, is that dividend-paying stocks are probably better directed at the extras in your budget and the items that are a little bit more discretionary. Hopefully, as those dividends grow, they do two things. They keep up with inflation, number one, and number two, they provide you a little bit of extra spending money for those extras in your budget. So you're sort of combining together the less predictable sources of income with the more predictable sources of income to make up an overall family income picture that meets the essential needs first and then takes care of the extras with some of these more moving parts as far as the investment income is concerned in the portfolio. So again, Jerry's pension was $48,000. Their combined Social Securities for both of them was $39,000. Between, and the bonds, again, very predictable income, $14,800. That leads us to a total predictable income stream of almost $102,000. So we covered all of their essentials with very predictable sources of income. And then the extras were taken care of with the dividends. That's their travel and their golf. Those were covered by the more moving parts of the portfolio. So again, you want to make sure that your absolute fixed cost of living, your must-haves, are covered by fairly predictable sources of income. And the more discretionary stuff, you can use the dividend-paying stocks to cover those.
Now, one other aspect in concluding this case is they had three children, and one of the issues that came up during the planning process, not a lot of financial discipline with their kids, and especially in two of the marriages where the spouses tend to be more on the spending side, and they were rather concerned with if something happened to both of them down the road, since a significant portion of their estate, roughly out of the $1.5 million net worth, almost two-thirds of it was made up of their IRAs. And if you're familiar with IRAs, a husband or a wife can leave their IRA to their surviving spouse. There is no tax. But then you start running into tax issues when the last spouse passes away. And what they wanted to make sure is that none of these assets went directly to the kids because they would just blow through them and spend through them. So what we did is we set up a trust deed IRA. There's another acronym known for it, but it's called an individual retirement trust. And what this would be, instead of a custodial for their IRA, which is probably what 99% of the people in this country have for their IRA, we set up a trustee, and that trustee will then take over the IRA upon the death of the last spouse and will distribute that IRA over a period of time, which is legal, less taxes, to their three children. So they don't have to worry about if they got a lump sum payment, not only the taxes that would have to be paid, but also the fact that there's a tendency within the family to be spendthrifts. And they wanted to make sure that their own children would have some semblance of a retirement inheriting their IRAs. And that was the last part of the plan that we completed. But there's a couple things here, if we can just sum up here. Making sure your fixed expenses are covered with predictable sources of income. And then the extraneous type expenses, you know, the travel expenses, which are probably more prevalent in the early years of retirement. And then let's say hobbies like golf were covered with things like from stock dividends. But remember, folks, as you age too, your spending priorities will shift. They may shift from travel, which you may be doing less of, to more of, let's say, medical expenses, covering those in the latter years. And they wanted to make sure they had enough money and would be able to maintain their lifestyle. So all of this was put together with different asset classes and then also wrapping it all up with an estate plan to protect their IRAs for what could be some spendthrift situations with their kids, so that they could feel comfortable that if something happened to them, this money just wasn't going to be basically going on a spending spree and leaving their kids little for their own retirement, especially since the job market is probably less secure for their kids than, let's say, with Jerry and Carla. Jerry working for a defense contractor for his entire career. Very few people can get to retirement, especially among the boomers, and say, hey, I spent 30 years with the company. I got a pension plan, an IRA, or a rollover in benefits. Fortunately for Jerry, his employer was a large defense contractor and he got those benefits.
Well, Jim, you know, this week you and I focused on a very specific income solution. very specific asset classes, very specific purposes, very specific targets. You know, last week we covered a lot of different income ideas for people who are seeking income in retirement, whether it was CDs or money markets or it was MLPs or maybe it was some other type of investment. We also talked very briefly last week about different types of real estate income. And again, this is a question we get a lot from people is it time to do real estate again? And so I'm really glad you're going to be talking with Dani Evanson right after this, because this is her area, is real estate investment. So I'm glad that our listeners will have a chance to hear a little bit more from an expert in the field about what's going on in real estate and how you can invest in real estate right now.
All that coming up right after this. At a time when interest rates are at zero and likely to remain there for some time, investors are scrambling for yield. So where do you go to find a decent return that's going to keep you up with inflation? Joining me on the program is Dani Evanson. She's Managing Director of RMA Real Estate Investment and Advisory Services. Dani, I want to begin with something that has transpired over the last couple of years. A lot of well-to-do individuals are now looking outside the bond market and the stock market, and they're looking at real estate again. What do you think's driving this?
Oh, by far, it's the lack of interest elsewhere. With respect to the rest of the portfolio, when yield is being compressed the way it is, people are seeking it in alternatives. And one of those alternatives is definitely going to be real estate.
Now, one thing about real estate, as opposed to, let's say, if I buy a stock or a bond, if I don't like it, or if I need money, I can, you know, press a button and 3 days later, I have my money. What I found rather surprising in some of these surveys that they've been talking about, investors are willing to forego some liquidity for these higher rate of returns. Obviously, if I buy an apartment unit, I buy a commercial building, I don't have the liquidity that I have with a stock or bond.
That is true with the illiquid portion of a real estate portfolio, but in today's market, there are alternatives to illiquidity. So there are liquid products, a whole host of them that have pros and cons associated with them that are now offering the consumer a liquid option.
Now, Dani, are you talking about things like REITs that are listed on the stock exchange that, you know, I can get REITs in commercial property, I can get them in multifamily units or even retail properties? Are you referring to that?
That, along with products from some institutions that are providing private funds with redemption options. So what that mechanism offers is a lockout for either 30, 60, or 90 days, but does provide an ability to exit in a short manner. So there's multiple options for liquidity, whether it's the public markets and equities, what you've described, but also alternative funds, vehicles that have options for exit.
Well, it's really surprising that a lot of money is going into this area. And you talk about there's sort of two strategy camps within the real estate market. There are clients who are looking for, let's say, cash flow, low-risk properties, which would include, let's say, multifamily apartment buildings, assisted living, or industrial space. And then there's the other camp that are looking for value-added, high returns of investment, things like development projects or turnaround opportunities. Contrast those two in what kind of investor gravitates to either one.
Sure. The two camps that we describe and the one that you mentioned are really in those two, and we haven't seen a blend. So we don't have a client, at least in our shop, that has asked us to define yield but yet have a portfolio allocation towards opportunistic and value add, which typically do not have yield in the first 3 years of a hold period. So what we found were clients were, as you mentioned, gravitating to one or the other. So let's describe the client attracted to yield. They are looking for alternatives to the bonds and fixed income portions of their portfolio. They're attracted to the property types that you've just mentioned. The other camp, or what we define as higher risk and longer term investors, are really looking for capital appreciation and putting their money to work for a longer period of time, but have the expectation of definitely higher returns. So when we have a cash yielding client interested in real estate, their real estate overall target portfolio return is going to be lower than that of someone who has a higher risk tolerance.
And you don't really see crossovers. It's almost like it would be two types of investor, income investor, growth investor.
Absolutely. And then there's those clients that have a general balance, but it's rare to find them attracted to a lower return and a cash component. I mean, we really are seeing a bifurcation of interest when it comes to the real estate.
Now, just looking in the article I read about, you've got about 28% of your portfolio on what I call multifamily properties, followed by offices, 18%, and retail, 12%, and maybe land development, 3%, and the least, storage. Tell us a little bit about your thinking and what's driving that.
Well, our portfolio has been created over the last 15 years. So having a snapshot today of our current allocation is not necessarily indicative of where we would put our capital today and what we find to be attractive opportunities. But regardless of what period we're in, diversification is critical. So we focus on continually providing our clients a diversified portfolio, and then we turn the dial up or down on certain strategies given market conditions. So, for example, multifamily is really heated today. We find that the pricing is very aggressive, and to really find an opportunity in multifamily, we have to be incredibly particular. Whereas 2 years ago, multifamily was a great opportunity, a lot of great buys, interesting markets and basis that we were attracted to.
You know, it's amazing as you look at how wealth has been built in this country with people starting their own companies or in real estate, that the wealthy are going back to getting direct stakes and brick and mortar again, which is kind of funny because you think about what's happening in e-commerce that is moving away from brick and mortar.
It's true, but bricks and mortar are not just office. So bricks and mortars include so many other occupancies. We cover the gamut of product type. So people are always going to have to live in bricks and mortars, and they will have to hold inventory in bricks and mortars and ship and cold storage, and the aged will always have to be in senior homes. So there's a lot of other bricks and mortars that define the communities other than office, which I agree, e-commerce is definitely changing the way that they occupy office product.
You know, something else that this article on real estate talked about that's a trend, it's called clubbing. Can you explain what clubbing is, where various wealth offices or wealth management offices sort of pull their resources together on projects?
Sure. That's what we do. We provide a clubbing mechanism. Clubbing is, for just a different description, is whereby you aggregate a few investors, so a handful, to have purchasing power and provide equity into a transaction. So there's a couple of different types. What we've seen in the marketplace, certainly in the last 3 to 4 years, are real estate family offices raising capital from other family offices, particularly non-real estate family offices, and acquiring and developing real estate through that syndication model. Then there's groups like RMA. So RMA clubs its underlying clients together to provide equity to local operating partners. And so if you have a client that has a few million dollars to deploy in a single asset, and you have a few of those clients, you have upwards to $10 to $15 million of equity, which can actually acquire a larger piece of real estate, a more institutional piece of real estate. So that clubbing provides access and purchasing power.
Now, one of the things about real estate trends, we have seen an uptick in real estate prices here over the last couple of years, especially with the low mortgage rates that we've seen that are still in place, even though they've risen. But there's also a trend to moving towards foreign real estate. For example, the article talked about opportunities in Europe where they're sort of behind us in terms of economic recovery and the pricing mechanism is maybe more favorable. Do you buy that?
In certain markets, that's true, but certainly not for London or major markets. So if you're in Berlin, that would not be the case. So pricing in core markets have trailed very similar to the ones in the U.S. So, for example, San Francisco's had an enormous uptick along with New York, Seattle, and the same would be true for European core markets. The secondary markets have a lot more room to go as opposed to the secondary markets in the U.S.
Now, another thing that they've said that has been a little bit different in this cycle, because I can remember the S&L crisis where I was able to buy my first office building. Back in those days, Danny, you could go to a bank and if there was a mortgage of a dollar, you could give them 60 cents on the dollar. In this latest era, I guess maybe the lessons learned from the RTC era was not to give away valuable assets for cents on the dollar. And I noticed that even in short sales here, banks, even though they're sitting on foreclosed properties, have not been to the point where they just put all those properties on the market, just trying to get them off the balance sheet, wipe them out, but in the process, you know, give away assets at very cheap prices.
Right. We've seen banks dole out sporadically small tapes of assets, and they've really held on to a lot. And to their credit, because of the recovery, their asset values have increased. And for those that are now over a 1.0 or 1x on the debt level are now starting to put them to the market. But again, they're receiving 100% of their debt dollar. So there's been a tremendous shift in what happened in the late 80s and early 90s.
And what about this idea that where the bargains are? We know that, for example, during the real estate bubble the last decade, you saw tremendous overbuilding in places like Vegas, places in Florida, Phoenix, Arizona, and even here in California. What do those markets look like for opportunity? Are those opportunities gone? Because I know a couple of years ago, we went looking in Vegas, and there was hedge funds that were coming in and buying large swaths of property all at once with the idea of bringing them in, injecting the capital, bringing in management, revitalizing the property. Are those opportunities pretty much gone in this market?
They're few and far between. I mean, they're never 100% gone. I think there's always the scrappy investment operator that can find unique deals. But for the most part, it's a very efficient market. And when you have millions of dollars entering into a market at one time, those prices are going to adjust very, very quickly. And those bargains and those steals are going to be nearly impossible.
You know, Dan, one thing that we often hear now about the stock market was up double digits in 2012. It was up one of the best years in 2013. So, you know, stocks aren't cheap, but they're certainly not in bubble territory. How would you define today's real estate opportunities? Would you say they're not cheap, but they're not in bubble territory as well?
You know, that's a hard comparison. I mean, I've never really thought of equities and real estate in those terms before, but one of the factors that real estate enjoys is that the volatility isn't daily like the stock market is. So when you have volatility that's daily, that spread is going to be more dramatic than real estate. So the bubble exists primarily due to the low interest rate we talked about at the beginning of the conversation. But at the end of the day, if the fundamentals are strong, which we perceive them to be, rent growth will continue. So the other drivers besides the stock market and interest rate is GDP and employment growth. So we look at those factors as well. And we would say that there are some markets that have a tremendous amount of capital chasing the same type of real estate, which creates an inflation in the price. And there's other markets that aren't experiencing that.
I was reading an article on real estate where the cap rates on commercial real estate have stood out better. They haven't come down as much as in multifamily. What do you think accounts for that?
A lot of it has to do with the debt level. The rate you can have on multifamily is lower than other commercial product type. So one, the debt's cheaper. And two, there's more capital in the market for multifamily. So it's driven by the amount of debt available to that product type as well.
Do you think the opportunities in multifamily are going to be with us for a while? I was reading an article, you know, you take a look at the real estate recovery. There's less first-time home buyers now because of household formations. You know, John and Susie are coming out of college with 70 to 100 grand worth of debt. That doesn't make them good qualified candidates to buy a first home or have the 20% down. So the rental market seems to have been, at least the people I've talked to, has remained strong. And do you think that's a trend that is likely to stay with us because of these demographic and financial changes?
We do. And also the economics of different research groups would concur as well. I mean, they're forecasting in just a strong market, let alone a core market, 4 to 5% growth per year for the next 3 years. That's a very strong growth rate. In core markets, you can see them above that. In secondary markets, they're trending at 2 to 3%. So the fact that all predictions are trending towards growth, I think multifamily is definitely going to provide a strong investment, but it's really your basis. What are you buying it at?
Well, it seems to me that, you know, there's always been the importance of diversification, and that has applied throughout the history of investing. You don't put all your eggs in one basket. And if you're looking for returns, you know, there was a gravitation to the bond market coming out of the crisis. Now there seems to be a reflection, especially by those of means, that, you know what, owning some brick and mortar, some real assets makes a lot of sense. Danny, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work you guys do at RMA, how could they do so?
They could start by looking at our website at www.rmare, which stands for the real estate.com, and they can find our contact information there.
Well, listen, Danny, thanks so much for joining us on the program. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income Show. Rather interesting at a time when everybody's searching for yield. Well, it comes back to different asset classes. Not surprising, real estate being one of them, where the yields are actually much better than anything you can get in the bond market. Well, on behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on this week's Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.